and bringing home guy after guy to his bed. The second hardest thing he's ever done was confronting her with a tape and ending their engagement. Today he's married with a beautiful family, married to someone else. He told me this story one summer while we drove to Idaho to help identify a body the police said might be our father. The body was found shot next to the body of a woman in a burned-out garage in the mountains outside Kendrick, Idaho. This was the summer of 1999, the summer the Fight Club movie came out. We went to my father's house in the mountains outside of Spokane, trying to track down some x-rays that showed the two vertebrae fused in Dad's back after a railroad accident left him disabled. My father's place in the mountains was beautiful. Hundreds of acres, wild turkeys and moose and deer everywhere. On the road up to the house, there was a new sign. It was next to a boulder that lay beside the road. It said Kismet Rock. We had no idea what the sign meant. Once at a toga party, I was drinking with a friend, Cindy, and she said, "Let me tell you about my mother. My mother gets married a lot." It was such a great line. I used it in Invisible Monsters. I knew exactly what Cindy meant. Part of visiting my dad was always meeting his latest girlfriend, or wife. Before my brother and I could find the x-rays, the police called to say the body was Dad's. They'd used dental records we'd shipped to them earlier. At the trial for the man who murdered him, it came out that my father had answered a personal ad placed by a woman whose ex-husband had threatened to kill her and any man he ever found her with. The title of the personal ad was Kismet. My father was one of the five men who answered it. He was the one she chose. This was the dead woman found beside my father. She and my father had gone to her home to feed some animals before driving to my father's house, where he was going to surprise her with a Kismet Rock sign, a sort of landmark named for their new relationship. Her ex-husband was waiting, and he followed them up the driveway. According to the court's verdict, he killed them and set fire to their bodies in the garage. They'd known each other for less than 2 months. That first support group for sex addicts. I went because I wanted to understand my father. I wanted to know what he dealt with and why his life was girlfriend after girlfriend, wife after wife. At the meeting in the church conference room, here were very everyday-looking people telling stories that even their spouses didn't know. I just sat there, and even though everyone was supposed to limit their sharing to a few minutes, we always ran out of time before everyone had a chance to speak. People were so hungry to share their pain. Several months after meeting Bill, after his story about blowjobs on Christmas Day, he came to the group upset. The fourth step in the 12-step program is to keep a record of your addiction, recording all your transgressions present. Bill's wife had found his notebook. She told him she made copies, and if he didn't give her the kids, the money, the house, the cars, and then move to another state, she was going to give copies of the notebook to all his friends and family. Bill was frantic, and his only way out, he told everyone, was to go home and kill her and kill himself. He seemed so resolved. I kept thinking, this is how it happens. All those newspaper stories about murder-suicides, this is how they happen. The group got Bill calmed down. He wept. A few weeks later, he and his wife had resolved to stay married and face his addiction together. During this time, a friend introduced me to a woman. This was at breakfast in a restaurant, and it was funny because her name was Marla, like Marla Singer in Fight Club. I'd never met a real Marla, and it turned out that she was a therapist who worked with sexual compulsives. Piece by piece, the ideas and themes of Choke were coming together. I wanted to write about the moment when your addictions no longer hide the truth from you, when your whole life breaks down. That's the moment when you have to somehow choose what your life is going to be about. Doping yourself with sex or drugs or food, or choosing something like riding, bodybuilding, gardening. True, in a way, this is trading one compulsive behavior for another, but at least with a new one, you're choosing it. Funny, but all my former junkie friends are either fervent Christians or triathletes. Nothing in half measures. As Paige Marshall says in the book, you have to trade your youth for something. With Choke, I wanted to show someone actively choosing their future instead of perpetuating their past. Here, I want to tell you how lovely and clever my brother's former fiancée was. I want you to know how happy it felt to see Bill resolve to save his marriage. I want to tell you how my father spent years with my brother and I, building huge model train sets with papier-mâché mountain ranges and working streetlights. We'd go to town, to Bailey's Toys and Hobbies, and buy a new locomotive for our birthdays. We'd glue specks of sand just so to create the perfect miniature roadbed for our tracks. Yeah, it sounds like compulsive behavior, but it was really sweet. Here at the end, I want to thank you for your time and attention, and thank you for taking a chance with my books. This is the story behind the story. I'll shut up now.
We're speaking with Chuck Palahniuk. Chuck, many of your characters find happiness by doing things that not only physically hurt them, but also thrive on deceiving those around them and society at large. Can you expand on this?
My characters are always trying to run a scam, but not to make money. They're always running some sort of a scam to get their emotional needs met. Because even in movies like The Sting, where people are trying to get a lot of money, you know that money is going to be spent getting their emotional needs met. So instead of putting the step of money in there, I always try to put in the actual emotional need that people are trying to fool people into fulfilling for them. And so that's where the deception comes in. And I think because readers can see that need within themselves, they're ready to forgive the character for running the scam. And they get hurt because, as a writer, I'm trying to get people to feel the way the character feels. Because that way, the reader is involved cognitively, emotionally, and physically in the story, and is more likely to sort of lose a sense of themselves while they're reading the story. That's why people tend to get hurt. That's why they tend to get sick in my stories, so that there's a physical sensation to get a physical, sympathetic response from the reader.
Have you ever choked?
No, I've never choked, literally. I thought about choking once to get out of a bar bill, and I would have been choking on the lid of a ketchup bottle. I was looking around for something smooth enough that it wouldn't tear my throat up, but also big enough that I couldn't inhale it. But thank God some friends showed up with money before I had to make a choice.
How did you arrive at the character of Victor Mancini?
I invented Victor one night when I was driving home in the dark, and I was dressed in a suit, and I was driving back from the grocery store, I think, and my father had just been killed, and it seemed like so much was going on in my life, and I was so overwhelmed by it all. And I thought about just pulling over to the side of the road and then leaving the headlights on, but walking a little ways up ahead and lying face down on the side of the road, knowing that some authority figure, whether it was a policeman or a paramedic, somebody would show up in a uniform, and that they would put their arms around me, and that they would roll me over and eventually sort of coax me back into my life by telling me that I was okay. And I thought, you know, the only thing that would make this sort of addiction to resurrection, this sort of almost parental assurance, the sort of presence of God telling you that everything is okay, that you're okay, that you can go on with it, the only thing that would make it better would be if you did this in a very public way. And so that's when I started thinking about Victor, who would fake choking so that people could, in a way, hug him and reassure him that he was all right.
There's a conversation posted on Powells.com. In it, you mentioned the concept of obsessive passions. Can you talk about this a bit?
I think obsessive passions is probably another term for coping mechanisms, and that's really what anything that I care about in my life is, a coping mechanism. I write to sort of make sense out of my experience and the stories that other people tell me, and other things like exercise or building with stone are ways that I exhaust myself so that I can sleep at nights. They're all really just coping mechanisms.
This concept, how does it appear in your work in general?
In a way, I don't think I'm so great a writer as much as I am just a good organizer. I always love to do files, you know, to organize and file my tax records obsessively and cross-reference them all. And in a way, when I write a story, it's my effort to take all the stories that I've been told over a period of time and collect them and somehow sort of cross-reference them all and try to make them add up to something, to total them into something that is sort of greater than the sum of all their parts. So, in a way, you know, it's my effort to sort of, you know, quilt together a lot of seemingly disparate things.
In Chok, you have Colonial Dunsborough, a living museum. Where did you get the idea for that?
A lot of my friends work for service industries, whether they're airlines or hotels, and they'll grow three-day goatees, or they'll wear their nose rings and always have to take them out on that fourth day when they go back to work. Their appearance is sort of orchestrated by their job. And originally, Colonial Dunsborough was a short story about a punk girl who had violated her appearance so many times that she was being burned as a witch. And everyone stood around and videotaped it, thinking it was just a fake event, but she was actually being tortured and burned to death. And no one would take it seriously because she had dyed her hair and worn her lip ring too many times.
There's a rumor going around that you haven't owned a television in about 10 years. What form of media has the biggest impact on you and your work?
The biggest impact is always writing, is always books. Because once I gave up television, I decided that if I was going to write, then what I needed to do was read. And so, at that point, my life started filling up with books. And that's really all that there is at this point, books and music on CDs.
What have you learned about your own work from reading it?
Reading my work out loud is really humbling, because all that I'm aware of are the very obvious sort of, you know, stylistic tics and rhetorical tics that I tend to rely on time and time again. And so reading it out loud is, in a way, maybe a kick in the pants that maybe I'll develop some new stylistic tics. This is Chuck Palahniuk. We hope you have enjoyed this production of Chok. This program was produced and directed by John McElroy. Executive producer, Dan Zitt. Text copyright 2002 by Chuck Palahniuk. Copyright 2002, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.